Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Betty Driver. For more than 40 years, she's been pulling pints and dishing up her hot pot in The Rover's Return. But her career in show business started decades before she took up residence on Britain's most famous street. She was a child when her mother put her on the stage, touring the country with an act that showcased her stunning singing voice. It brought success, but not happiness. I did it for over 20 years, she says, and hated every day of it. While life offstage was far from easy, her career prospered. She had her own radio series and was a respected actor in film and television, working with everyone from Arthur Askey and Noel Coward to Bruce Forsyth and Tommy Cooper. She thought she'd retired in 1966. Then a phone call came from out of the blue asking her to join the cast of something called Coronation Street. I thought it would be for 6 episodes and then I'd be home again. I wouldn't change my life, she says, though I'd have liked a bit more happiness. Betty Driver, welcome. You are unbelievably 90 now. You sit opposite me, rude with health.
Oh, never mind.
You've been working for the past 80 years.
Yes, I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Does retirement hold no appeal?
I just love working. And I will never retire, ever. They'll have to shoot me to get rid of me.
Well, certainly make a big viewing figures in that particular episode, I'm
sure. True.
What is it about the work that you love so much?
I think I just love people, you see, and I love the cast. I've made tremendous friends. I mean, when you're in the theatre, when you're doing variety, you work for a week and you meet somebody, you may never meet them again. So you don't really make friends. When I join the street, I've made friends and I'm the happiest person in the world. It's just like a big family and I just love it.
That is lovely to hear you say that there is a great sense of happiness, because I know, and hopefully we'll talk about this in a little bit more detail,
yes.
I know in your early life there wasn't a lot of happiness around.
No.
So now you think you've found a sense in which you feel fulfilled.
I know, we had no happiness when we were little. Me and my sister Frieda, no, we went to a different school each week, which was horrendous. So you never really caught up on any education. It was awful. We had a mother that was a matriarch, and she just wanted me to be in the theatre, irrespective of whether I wanted to or not. And she wanted me to sound like Gracie Fields, and I hated Gracie Fields. So constantly, it was a battle.
We'll talk a lot more about that a little
yes.
later. But do you remember getting that first call for something called Coronation Street and them saying, you know, we think we'd like you to...
Oh, yes, it was amazing. We took a little pub in Derbyshire and one day the phone went and it was executive producer of Coronation Street. He said, could I come and see you? I said, no, don't be so daft. It's a pub. Of course you can come and see me. And yes, come on. So he came round. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, you're pulling pints here. Why don't you come and pull pints in The Rover's Return? I said, where's that? He said, in Coronation Street. I said, yes. And I said, well, we'll probably do about 6 episodes and I'll be back. 41 years later, I'm still churning out hot pot. It's amazing.
It is amazing. I couldn't help, of course, but mention the hot pot. Do you know how to make hot pot?
No. No. I'm dreadful. I'm a terrible cook. My friends, I've got 7 men friends, and they all know I'm rubbish in the kitchen. I really am rubbish. I mean, I bought some steak the other week, and I looked at it, and I thought, it's a bit thick, that I bet that'll be tough. And I hammered hell out of this piece of meat. You could have sold your shoes with it. And of course, I tried to eat it at the end. No way. Went straight into the bin.
Speaking of which, now, tell me why you've chosen this first piece of music and tell me what it is.
Oh, I want to apologise to start with for playing this piece of music, which I can't stand. I can't bear my voice. I hated it when I did when I was 18 and I'm 90 now. And, I just can't bear it. But all my friends like it, you see, so... I did it when I was making a film. I got a contract to do 3 films and this song was in one of the films. And it did... did quite well, and I thought, ooh, I'm going to be a big film star. Ooh, lovely, you know. I finished the 3 films, and then the war broke out, and all the contracts were cancelled. So that was the end of my filming career. I've hidden these records. I've got really old records right at the back of the wardrobe so nobody would find them at all. But my friends, oh, they're like little squirrels, you know, they found this. And it's called I'll Take Romance. Oh.
I'll take romance while my heart is young and eager to fly. I'll give my heart a try. I'll take romance. I'll take romance while my
That was my castaway, Betty Driver, and I'll Take Romance. We placed that at the top of our eight discs today, Betty, because you promised us you really wanted to get it out of the way quickly.
Yes, I
because
did. You... Are we still friends?
I liked it.
Oh,
you played
dear.
It because your friends implored you to put it on your list, but I noticed all the way through that you were grimacing and you were huffing and puffing.
Oh, no,
and...
I can't bear it.
What?
I can't bear it. It's no good. I sound like an old tin can.
That was released then in 1938. You were 17, 18. By that time, you'd already starred in a West End show. As we know, you'd taken on your first film roles, spent a good number of years in rep, and all because Mummy wanted you on the stage.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I did a season in rep when I was about 11.
Right.
But it was very good for me because it taught me how to learn lines and how to enter onto a stage and, I don't know, it was probably very, very good for me.
Probably. But did you say to your mother, I don't want to do this?
Yeah, every day. She said, you're going to do it no matter what. No love attached at all. I mean, nothing. We never got a kiss. We never got a present. Nothing.
What did your father have to say about this?
Well... My mother was so strong that I think my dad just gave up. He was a sweet person, but he just gave up. She was so domineering that there was nothing you could do about it.
Why did she want you to do it? Was it the money?
I don't know. I will never know. It was just very, very sad little life, me and my sister, you know.
It's an unusual degree of cruelty, though, that doesn't allow a child to celebrate Christmas or birthdays or give them a hug. Or where did that come from? Why
I don't
wasn't
know.
She,
no. We never, no, we didn't. We always had a Christmas tree and Daddy used to put lights on it and it was lovely. And Frieda and I used to put our little presents all around, which we'd bought during the year for them. But there was never one from my mum or my dad, ever. Never. From the age of, I think, 7 was the last time we ever had a present.
So those presents that you'd got, had you got them for your parents?
Yes, yes. My grandma and my granddad, my mum and my dad and aunties and that, all there, but we never got anything. And we never got a kiss, only on New Year's Eve. The bells would go for New Year's Eve and my dad would say, Happy New Year, a kiss on the cheek. And my mum would grudgingly say, Happy New Year, right, that's it. That was the love for the year.
When you were a grown-up, did you ever have it out with your mother? Did you ever say, what was all that about? Why?
No, there's no point.
No.
I think she always wanted to be on the stage and never really achieved anything. So that was the nearest thing to me, bunging me on, you know, as a little girl. I mean, she used to stand on the side of the stage and obviously this night I didn't do it and came off and wham, straight across my face and had to go and take a curtain call with this great big red hand mark and crying. Oh, it was awful, really awful, but she was just a go-getter. I don't know whether it was I never saw any money. I mean, my mother did all the money bits, so Frieda and I got about half a crown a week. And when I was 21, I got 10 shillings a week. Isn't it awful, really?
It is. It is
you
awful.
Know.
Let's have some more music and tell me about what we're going to hear for disc number 2, Betty.
Oh, yes, Stephen Hoff, great friend of mine, a world-class pianist. Oh, I just think he is so, so wonderful. And I would love you to play the Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto. It's gorgeous.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Hoff playing the opening of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor. So, Betty Driver, you've already, and we've only just started talking, mentioned your sister Frida many times.
Yeah.
She was your younger sister.
Yes, yes, 2.5 years younger.
And was she the person then who made life bearable as a
little
girl?
Yes, she was like a little rock. We lived together nearly all our lives.
Was she a performer?
She was a very beautiful coloratura soprano.
Was she?
And I had her trained at the Royal College of Music. But my mother didn't want to know about that. She said, no, no, variety's all right for us. And she finished it and just absolutely broke Frida's heart.
So you paid for her training,
yes,
and she studied,
yes,
and
yes,
she had a promising,
yes,
career. Of course, kids always want to please their parents, don't they? That's that's the awful,
yeah,
truth of it. I'm constantly struck as you speak about your mother of the mother in the wings in Gypsy shouting, "Sing out, Louise!" Was she one of those? She
Oh, yes. Well, she would have loved to have gone on the stage, but of course she had no talent. In a word. Oh, God, I don't know. Strange life.
Very strange. Do you think she sort of at once, you know, she knew obviously that you could go out there and earn cash, but do you think there was a bit of her that slightly resented the fact that you had the talent?
Oh, yes. She wanted me to be like Gracie Fields, and I did not want to be like Gracie Fields, and I would not sing like her.
Did you ever work on the same bill as Gracie Fields? Did you ever encounter her professionally?
Well, I had the same agent as Gracie Fields. One day I went to my agent's house, and a man and a woman stood there, this woman in a plastic raincoat, like a leopard skin, and a headscarf on, and dark glasses, and big flat brown shoes on. I thought, she's probably come to do a bit of cleaning, she's probably a cleaner or something. So my agent came down the stairs. She said, "Oh, hello, Betty, darling." She said, "You've met Grace, haven't you?" I said, "Oh, it's a great pleasure." And Grace, if he has looked at me from the bottom to the top, she went, "Likewise, I'm sure." And that's the only thing she ever said to me. She was very jealous of me because I was only, when I went into the show that she had made famous, I was 14.
Yes, that
the
was
leading lady.
That was quite a show to carry.
Yes.
At 14.
14 years of age.
And hadn't you auditioned at the Windmill Theatre around about the same time?
Oh, don't, yes. I happened to look to the side in the wings and saw a load of girls with no clothes on. Well, I'd never seen anybody with no clothes on, ever. I was very shy. Then I looked the other side, and the boys were there with no clothes on. Well, that was the end of that.
And
I just grabbed my handbag, and off I shot down Shaftesbury Avenue. It was horrendous.
Now, your mother taking you to the Windmill Theatre,
yeah,
when you were just a young girl, I mean, it was world famous for the fact that it had these nude, they weren't quite dancers, because they weren't really allowed to move, but they had a feather,
yeah,
that they moved.
Yes.
So she knew what she was doing when,
yeah,
she took you to the windmill.
Yeah. As I say, I'd never seen anybody without the clothes on. I thought, oh, aren't they rude? You know, but how naive can you be?
Betty, we're on disc number 3. Tell me about this. Tell me why you've chosen this track now.
This Ella Fitzgerald.
Yes.
Oh, I think thought she was so wonderful. Apparently she lived on the borders of Canada and America, and she used to get Coronation Street, and she watched every episode. She used to write to us, we sent her tapes and photographs, and she was such a brilliant technician. You know, she was magical, really. Night and day, you are the one, only you beneath the moon and under the sun. It's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you night and day. That was Ella Fitzgerald and Night and Day. So inevitably, Betty Driver, your talent as a young woman took you into the movies. Your first film was with George Formby, is, yes,
that right? You went on a little later to work with, must have been quite a young Carol Reed as director.
Oh, yes.
How did that go?
Oh, it was wonderful. He directed my first film. He was a kind, very kind man. He used to take me through all my scenes and say, this is how I want it, now try and do it this way. So brilliant. I'd no idea that people could be kind like that. I thought you would just be shoved on and that was it. But he was lovely.
And did Hollywood ever come calling? Because I'm thinking this was a time, maybe a little bit before, but sort of Lucille Ball time, when it was fine for
women.
I know lots of people who watch you and Corey,
yeah,
say they love your comic timing.
Yeah.
I can't help thinking that that could have been a possibility for you.
Yes, it could have,
yes.
Yeah, but no, she didn't want to know. I think I had a couple of inquiries to go to do something on Broadway, but of course, Mummy didn't want to know about that. We're not going there. No way we're not going to there. No. All she wanted me to do was variety.
What was your mother spending all the money on? Do you know?
No, I don't know.
But did your mother and father have a grand house? And did they?
No. But she had a good time.
Was she a drinker, a gambler?
No, she didn't drink or gamble. I don't know where she went or what she did. I don't know. We never, ever did find out, Frieda and I.
You were in your, were you in your mid-30s when your mother died?
Yeah.
Were you there when she died?
No, I wasn't. No, my sister was with her. Oh, it was awful, awful.
And did she have any final conversation with your sister?
With my sister. She asked her to forgive her. Will you forgive me?
Did she?
Mm. Well, what do you say? He said, yes, of course you do.
Did you ever, could you forgive her in your heart? No.
No, she never asked me to forgive. No. No, I was the meal ticket for the entire family. My mother, my father, my grandma, my granddad, my aunts, everyone. They all had a nice little share of my money.
See, you've got a very good sense of humour, haven't you? Because as you're saying that, yes, thank God.
Yes, thank God.
Yeah.
I have a tremendous sense of humour. A bit naughty sometimes, but I have a very, very good sense of humour.
Because there are people who could say the things that you're saying to me now across a microphone, and I would think that sort of killed their spirit. Not you. Here you are, all twinkly and...
Oh, yeah. I have a very good sense of humour, and I think that's what's got me through life.
Yes. We're going to hear disc number 4. What are we going to hear
now?
Oh,
gosh. Brass bands. Oh, I love brass bands. Now, I used to have a pub in Derbyshire, so I had to travel from Derbyshire to Granada. I stopped at some traffic lights and I could hear brass band music and I thought, wonder what where that is. I was following this noise. Must have looked insane. Followed it until we came to a little tiny single-storey building. And Sir Harry Mortimer came to the door and he said, can I help you? I said, well, I don't know. I said, I'm mad on brass bands. And he said, oh, it's you, the hot pot quiz. Yes. So I go and sit there. There I sat throughout their rehearsal. It was wonderful, beautiful.
That was Sir Harry Mortimer conducting the GUS Brass Band and Thunder and Lightning. You looked like you were really enjoying that, Betty Driver. In your younger days, I saw a terrific photograph of you in your autobiography of you standing next to Henry Hall and you're wearing this wonderful dark pantsuit. It's beautiful.
Oh, yes,
you look very, very glamorous. Do you remember having that photograph
taken?
Yes,
I do. That was during the war. That was when Coventry was bombed. And we were there at the theatre there the actual night that it was bombed. And I had Julie Andrews in the dressing room with me as a little girl, and she used to come on and sing in a little frilly frock and little bows on the shoes and that. And
did you think when you heard her sing, she's got something, by
golly?
Oh,
yes. She had a sweet voice, and she was a lovely little girl. I think she probably would only be about 12 or something like that. And she spent the entire week with me and Frieda. And, of course, the night the bombing was on, it was awful. And she slept in my dressing room, and Frieda and I slept on the floor. And we spent the entire night like that. And when we went out the next morning, of course, Coventry was, well, it was just flat. Terrible. But I've never, ever met Julie Andrews since. And I often wonder, did she ever remember that night?
I'm sure she did.
I'm sure she must do.
And you performed all the time throughout the war going on.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Abroad, everywhere.
You must have seen some terrible sights.
Oh, God, yes. Dreadful. I think the thing that sticks in my mind most of all, I can't remember whether it's Holland or Germany, I'm not sure, but it was the last place that boys went to before they came home. And it was called a delousing centre.
Right.
And we went, there were hundreds of them in this hall, and they all looked dead, these boys. The commanding officer said, well, I don't know whether they'll respond at all. Their faces were covered in white all over, and they looked like ghosts. They put a powder all over them to kill any lice or anything that's on them. Well, they had no expression at all on their faces, nothing. They just looked like dead boys. I said, now then, boys, I've got some very old songs, you know them, and I want you to sing with me. And one or two murmured, and I thought, oh, this is awful. So I come off the stage and go in the audience, and I said, now then, boys, come on, push these chairs back now. And I said, and I've got one boy there, sat on his knee, 19 he was, and oh, God, he was so poor, crying his eyes out. And I'm crying, I'm saying, look, you'll soon be home. Don't worry. You'll soon, your mum will still love you when you get home. Anyway, I sang to them for hours, and by the end of the time, they were cheering. And the commanding officer said, I don't believe it. I've never seen anything like that in my life. He said, from dead people to alive. And it was wonderful. We danced until the early hours of the morning, and they all were normal boys by the time we left. And to me, that was the most fantastic achievement. If I never do anything else in my life, I think I've done something wonderful there by bringing those boys back to life.
Unforgettable.
Yeah.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now? We're on disc number 5, Betty.
Oh, number 5. My great, dearest friend, a black girl called Winifred Atwell. She was a classically trained, but she made her name by playing honky-tonk music. I used to always have her on my variety bills because we were great friends. And she used to play the black and white rag. I used to love this.
That was Winifred Atwell and Black and White Rag, your good friend there, Betty Driver, bringing back lots of memories for you. You've mentioned on a few occasions Henry Hall. You were singing with Henry Hall in the BBC Dance Orchestra. You have said that if circumstances had been different, he might have been the man for you.
Yes, I adored him, but he was such a gentleman. He was wonderful to my sister and me. Very kind, sweet man. And I'd had a very bad nervous breakdown, and he got me back, you know, helped me back into, get my sanity back.
You were in your mid-20s when that happened. I mean, did you call it a nervous breakdown, or did you just think, I can't cope with my world anymore?
I just couldn't cope anymore. I just passed out on the stage while I was singing. I just blacked out. And, of course, they drew the curtains over, and my mother threw a cup of water all over me and said, come on, get up, you damn fool. Stop play-acting.
And so you had to go home because you couldn't, you physically couldn't.
I just couldn't cope anymore. It was I got agoraphobia.
Yes.
I was 18 months and I wouldn't go through the door. And Frieda was my god. And then one day Henry Hall phoned through to Frieda and said, is Betty any better? She said, well, a bit better. He said, look, I want you to try and get her to come and watch the band. So we go to Nottingham Empire. And I'm standing on the side of the stage and the band are playing and I think, oh, this is lovely. All of a sudden, I hear Henry say, there's somebody on the side of the stage who you love. And I would just like you to say hello to her because she's been not very well. And Frieda pushed me onto the stage. And, of course, I didn't see the audience. All I saw was Henry's face. And he said, you're fine. I'm with you. Nobody's going to hurt you. The audience is still there, all crying. I'm crying as well. But we started to sing this little song, and I sang it, and I finished the song. And from that day to this, I've never been off since.
Given that it came like a bolt from the blue, have you ever, when you've been performing live since, worried that it might come back, or have you put it to bed?
No, I would never let it, because I've got nobody that bullies me. And I think a lot of it was being bullied.
What was the point in your career when you started to do the things you wanted to do?
When my mother had to go home, she had very bad asthma. The day she went home, my sister said, right, we're changing all your music, we're changing your act, we're changing your gowns, that's it. And we did, gradually together. She was wonderful, my sister, an angel. She began to tell me I was good, which I'd never heard that word in my life. And it was through Frieda that I blossomed out.
Let's have another piece of music then. We're going to disc number 6 now.
Oh, now then. Ballet. I'm a very romantic person. You wouldn't think to look at me big and fat and old, would you? But I am very romantic. I love romantic music. I love Russian composers. And this one, Tchaikovsky, Swan Lake.
Leonard Slatkin conducting the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra and the Overture to Swan Lake by Tchaikovsky. Can we talk briefly about your marriage?
Well, it wasn't a very happy marriage. I mean, I think I did it out of spite, really, to get away from my mother. Got in with this man, and I loved him, but he loved other girls more than me.
He was a performer too, was he?
Yes, yes. He was a very South African chap. He was a lovely guitar player, and he played guitar in my act for me. But he was very jealous because I earned the money. It just was just awful.
He was quite good at spending your money.
Oh, yes, very good at that, yes. He wanted to be an agent, so I bought him an office in Bond Street, and it had just happened to be Winifred Atwell's husband owned this office. And Winnie's husband was very fond of me, and one day he went into the office to my husband and caught him with a girl there over the desk and gave him a damn good punching up and split his mouth, and he phoned me up. He said, I'm afraid I've hit your husband. I said, good.
In spite of all the years of being badly treated, you did follow him back home to his home to South Africa.
Yeah.
Why did
he came home one day. He said, right, I'm going home on Thursday. This is Tuesday. I said, South Africa. He said, yes. I said, well, what do you want me to do? Just please yourself. Now, I felt that in my life I wanted to be married, be happy to one person, and that was it. And it was just a hell of a shock when it didn't happen, you see. Anyway, he went to South Africa and he said, well, you stop here, sell this, then about 3 months' time, come over to South Africa. Like an idiot, I did.
And why did you do it? Why did you not? Because there you were with... The town.
I'm a stupid, that's why, because I just believed in marriage, and I believed that, you know, you should try and all that kind of, which is a load of rubbish, really. And I went there, and from a lovely home, I arrived in Johannesburg, and he said, we've managed to get a flat. I said, oh, good. Well, there was a bed in it, a table, two chairs, and a few pans, and I'd left this gorgeous, gorgeous house. I didn't know a soul in South Africa, and I stuck it for 4 months. And then one night he came home at 5 a.m. and he said, I'm in love. I said, well, that's nice. Who is she? He said, well, I don't know her name. I said, have you spoken to her? No. You don't know her name? No. And you're in love? I said, right. Oh, well, I said, good luck to you. So he gets on the phone to Frieda in Manchester. I said, will you send me my fare home? Because I haven't any money. He'd had it all. He went through a whole fortune. Completely gone. He takes me to the airport, never speaks to me ever again, dumped me in the middle of the airport with my cases and went, left. Didn't say bye-bye, nothing. And that was it. That was my life.
You never had any children?
No, I couldn't have children.
Do you think that, I mean, it's much more, what you've just described is much more than, you know, duty was a very important thing.
Yes.
It used to be,
yes.
And certainly in
yeah.
your generation, yeah. it was people yeah. who did their duty. But what you're describing to me is so much more than a sense of duty. I mean,
I know.
Why do you think you allowed him to treat you as badly as
I don't know. I don't know. I adored him to start with.
Did you?
But by the time I finished, I hated him.
Let's have some more music,
yeah.
Betty. Tell me what we're going to hear now.
Now then, Hoagie Carmichael, fabulous singer, lovely pianist, and he had a quaint voice, slightly hoarse and lovely. He used to do one little song that I absolutely fell in love with, and it was called Skylark.
Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring? Where my heart can go a-journeying over the shadows and the rain to a blossom-covered lane.
That was Hoagie Carmichael and Skylark. So tell me, Betty Driver, your working week these days is what? How often are you in the studio?
Well, the company are very, very kind to me. I'm only usually in no more than 2 days a week. They're wonderful with me, thank God.
And that's quite a nice balance, is it? You feel
oh,
like
yes.
you're engaged
yes.
and you're doing...
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
How much fan mail do you get?
Oh, tons. Oh, a heck of a lot of it from little children. Oh, yes, wonderful.
Well, wishing you were their grandma.
They want me to be their nana.
I bet they do.
It's wonderful. We had one the other day, I think, a little boy. I am six. My nana is very poorly at the moment and I think she's going to die. So will you be my nana because I love you? Oh, well, you can imagine the mess I'm in when I'm reading that. It's amazing.
Do you find that, it was interesting, I don't know how many years ago it was now, but you received a Lifetime Achievement Award for your contribution to the world of soap.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, we know that tens of millions of people will move nothing in their life to see their soap and to watch Coronation Street.
I know.
Are you able to, you know, to enjoy it, to think, yeah, you know what, I'm really, really good at what I do, and the reason I've had this long career is because people regard me very highly?
Well, it's a funny thing, you see. When you're in a show, my idea is that the audience have got to like you before they like the character. And I've been very fortunate. I had a character that could be liked. Deep down, I was very kind to people, more like a mother figure. But now I'm a nana figure. It's lovely.
So on the other days when you're not in at Coronation Street working, the other 5 days of the week, what else do you do for fun? You've got these friends around you, these
yes.
seven friends.
Well, I'm mad about flowers. I love the earth. Anything to do with the earth, I'm madly in love with. I would sooner have flowers than a meal.
So, of course, I'm about to, Betty Driver, cast you away onto a desert island. No more cast and friends around you for company.
Oh,
how's that going to be?
How lovely.
Well, you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy the peace and quiet,
oh, it's
will
beautiful.
You? Will you?
Beautiful.
What sort of desert island do you imagine for yourself? One with flowers, one with
oh,
exotic
yes.
blooms.
Oh, yes.
I'm wondering how you'll cope with the loneliness on the island. How will you be? I mean, it will be quite lonely.
I don't know. I don't see how you could be lonely with so much beauty around you, and I just adore everything to do with nature.
Do you think you might even start singing to yourself again?
Singing?
Yes.
Oh, I don't. Probably, yes. I can't sing myself now because I'm too old, but yes, probably would. I'd bore myself into the ground.
Tell me then, but we've come to your final disc today, Betty Driver. Tell me what it is we're going to hear now.
Oh, Stephen Isserlis. Cello player. Gosh, he's a great friend of Stephen Hoff, the pianist. And I go to their concerts. They do concerts at this little church in a place called Grappen Hall. Stephen Hoff plays the piano and Stephen Isserlis. And of course, Stephen Isserlis is such a sweet man. I mean, he's so lovely. And he walks on, I mean, before his move, he sat down, I'm in tears, because he walks on with this little battered cello. And, of course, it's the one instrument in the whole orchestra that makes me cry because it always sounds so lonely. And that lonely sound always makes me want to cry. I think it's so beautiful, but he's such a glorious, glorious player.
¶¶
That was Stephen Isserlis, accompanied by your good friend Stephen Hoff, playing the Adagio from Cello Sonata No. 2 in F major by Brahms. So, Betty, we come to the point in this programme where I'm going to give you some books. I give you the complete works of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I give you the Bible, and you can take another book too. What would you like to take?
Well, I'm not a reader, but one book that I love, I mean, it sounds stupid, is by Daphne du Maurier, Rebecca.
Oh, well, a lot of people
love that.
Yes.
I love that book.
You can have that. And we do allow you a little luxury to make life just a bit more bearable on the island. What would your luxury be?
Oh, dear. Perfume. I'm mad on perfume.
Are you?
I adore perfume.
Any particular type? Any particular make?
I use a perfume by Sicily called Eau de Soie,
right.
And it's absolutely glorious.
And if I were to ask you to pick just one of the eight, if you had to save one disc, which one would you pick?
Well, it's got to be Stephen Hoff, because he's a very dear friend of mine and I admire him tremendously.
The Tchaikovsky is yours. Betty yeah. Driver, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, greatest of pleasure. Lovely meeting you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.